Beto is in, Biden is beckoning, and we say goodbye to Birch Bayh on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Joe Biden may have tipped his hand about his White House plans. Will the Democratic Party's left wing give him a hearty welcome?
I don't think that the very progressive wing of the party is going to start out behind Biden. He's just not their candidate. But there are a lot of Democrats for whom he is appealing, not on an ideological basis, but because they think that he is the one who's best equipped to beat Trump.
Plus, Marianne Williamson hopes to bring spirituality and the power of healing into the battle for president.
We don't need to be displaying anger right now. We need to be displaying love, enlightenment, tolerance, non-judgment, and compassion. And that compassion has to also be extended to the people who don't agree with us.
And we remember Birch Bayh, the former Indiana senator and presidential hopeful, who led the way for two constitutional amendments.
And two that he sponsored, wrote, and did not pass are also still very important to us. First, of course, is the Equal Rights Amendment, which was passed and ratified by 38 states. Indiana was the last state. It was three states short of ratification.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 269 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. The news out of New Zealand was horrifying. A white nationalist entered two mosques in Christchurch and killed 50 Muslims for no apparent reason other than hatred. President Trump was asked if he thought white nationalism was becoming a serious threat.
I don't really. I think it's a small group of people that have very, very serious problems. I guess if you look at what happened in New Zealand, perhaps that's a case. I don't know.
And while he tweeted his warmest sympathy and best wishes to the people of New Zealand, he said nothing about the man who did the killings. But that was followed, not much later, by this tweet. The fake news media is working overtime to blame me for the horrible attack in New Zealand. And that was hardly the last of his tweets for the weekend. He went into another tirade against the late John McCain, his third in 2 days, for working with Democrats to prevent the killing of the Affordable Care Act. That even continued into Tuesday when, at a press availability, he was asked why he continues to criticize McCain 7 months after his death.
I'm very unhappy that he didn't repeal and replace Obamacare, as you know. He campaigned on repealing and replacing Obamacare for years. And then he got to a vote and he said, thumbs down. And our country would have saved $1 trillion and we would have had great health care. So he campaigned. He told us hours before that he was going to repeal and replace. And then for some reason, I think I understand the reason, he ended up going thumbs up. And frankly, had we even known that, I think we would have gotten a vote because we could have gotten somebody else. So I think that's disgraceful. Plus, there are other things. I was never a fan of John McCain and I never will be.
Back to the tweets. There were ones calling on Fox News to, quote, bring back Judge Jeanine Pirro, the host who was suspended for a week for suggesting that Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, a Muslim, did not support the Constitution because she wears a hijab. Trump tweeted at Fox, quote, stop working so hard on being politically correct, which will only bring you down, and continue to fight for our country. A wonderful message to send after the slaughter of 50 Muslims in New Zealand. He also had a tweet about crooked Hillary and the fake dossier. And for good measure, he called George Conway, the husband of presidential counselor Kellyanne Conway, a total loser and the husband from hell. This after George Conway said Trump was, quote, unfit and incompetent because of his, quote, narcissistic personality disorder. Trump even attacked Saturday Night Live, which had a rerun, and suggested that the Federal Communications Commission look into shows like SNL that criticize him. Of course, Trump can soon expect to see several potential challengers appear on the program as the 2020 campaign heats up, which leads to this week's trivia question. Who is the first declared presidential candidate ever to appear on Saturday Night Live? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned. When 12 Republicans decided to break ranks with President Trump last week and vote to overturn his national emergency declaration regarding money for his border wall, some saw it as a sign the party is standing up for principle, the separation of powers. But Trump said a yes vote meant a vote for Nancy Pelosi and open borders, and an overwhelming majority of the GOP conference agreed, just not the 12. Of course, in the end, Congress is not going to win this battle. Trump vetoed the bill almost as soon as the Senate voted, which followed similar action in the House.
Today I am vetoing this resolution. Congress has the freedom to pass this resolution, and I have the duty to veto it, and I'm very proud to veto it. And I'm very proud, as I said, of a lot of Republican senators that were with me. And I'm also very proud of the House. The Republicans in the House voted overwhelmingly in favor of a secure border.
No one thinks there are enough votes in either chamber to override the veto, but the fact that 12 Republicans stood up to the president, that's big news, right? On the other hand, of the 20 Republican senators up for re-election next year, one, just one, voted for the resolution. That was Susan Collins of Maine. Others talked about opposing Trump, but in the end fell short. Here was Tom Tillis of North Carolina on the Senate floor last month.
My problem right now has to do with an executive order that the emergency declaration that the president intends to send to Congress. I'm a member of the U.S. Senate. I'm a member of a co-equal branch that actually believes that this action falls within our purview. And now we're going to find out, because I'm sure it will be challenged in the courts. But I also worry not so much about this one, because, frankly, even the way this money is going to be programmed, I agree with it. What I worry about are future presidents and what they may do if we set this president going into the future.
Tillis even wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post explaining why he would vote against the president. But in the end, with no advance warning, he changed his vote. Ben Sasse, who, like Tillis, had expressed reservations about Trump's action, and who, like Tillis, is up for re-election next year, also supported the president. Carl Hulse is the chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times and is a keen observer of Congress. Carl, thanks for letting me drag you back onto the Political Junkie.
Happy to do it, Ken.
Well, I don't know exactly what to make of this. I mean, 12 Republicans in the Senate stand up for congressional authority and vote against Trump. But other than Susan Collins, every Republican up next year, including some who could be in tough races, like Cory Gardner and Tom Tillis and maybe Martha McSally and maybe David Perdue, they all voted with the president.
Yeah, I just think that that is a reflection still of the perceived hold and the actual hold that the president has on the Republican base. Republican senators, even those who are threatened next year, would rather not offend the president than stick up for their institution. Actually, the 12, I know that people have gotten, said, oh, that wasn't that big a deal, voting against the president. But it was a big deal. It's proven hard for the Republicans to do. Roy Blunt, already in Missouri, they're back during the recess, and he's been disinvited to a big county Republican dinner. That's not a small thing. Roy Blunt is about a Republican as you can get. He's been in the leadership in the House and in the Senate. He was the only member of the leadership Republican leadership to defy Trump. But he's on the Appropriations Committee. I think 6 of the 12 were, and they're protecting their prerogative there, but it's tough to do, and there's repercussions. Susan Collins, you mentioned, in some ways, it's to her political advantage right now to distance herself from Trump, but that's the kind of vote that can stir a primary and get you in trouble. I give the 12 credit for doing it. Mike Lee, who tried to get Trump to accept a deal on agreeing to fix the law that this was done under. It was never intended for the kind of emergency that Trump has declared. Mike Lee, when Trump said no, he went and voted against the president. I think that was kind of nervy. But these Senate Republicans do not want to get on the wrong side of Trump, because back home, Trump is more popular than they are. And that's just a fact.
Well, Rand Paul always threatens to vote against Trump, but he always seems to change his mind. But he stuck to his guns, too, this time.
Yeah, this was, to me anyway, as someone who's covered these separation of powers issues quite a bit, this was an egregious violation by the president. The Congress deliberated extensively and decided they were not going to provide the money for the president. He signed the spending bill, and then he goes around them. The one real power that the Congress has is the power to control spending. They dictate where the money is supposed to be spent. If you allow the president to start doing that, you have no power. I think this has been a real wake-up call for a lot of Republicans, even those who sided with the president.
Well, you know what? I want to play a little part of a commercial from a group called the Republicans for the Rule of Law, and this was before the vote. But they tried to influence the GOP to stay true to its principles. It quotes a whole bunch of Republican senators back when they were critical of President Obama's executive orders, which was a million years ago. Let me start now with Ted Cruz. I'm going to play part of that commercial now with Ted Cruz starting it.
This president can impose his own immigration laws unilaterally. We stop having a constitutional system of checks and balances. It's the power of a monarch or an emperor.
If Republicans were against executive overreach then, they should be against it now. Call Senator Alexander and tell him to terminate President Trump's unjustified emergency declaration.
Evidently, somebody did call Alexander.
Right. But he's also retiring, and that makes it a little easier, too.
Yeah, he's not running again. He's an institutionalist. But I think that this is one of the problems in our politics right now. There's just a mental block on both sides where one, it's terrible if the other side does it, but it's okay if my side does it. And I just think that the Republicans around the country who were so outraged at President Obama's use of the pen and phone, if you remember, that was his construction for moving ahead with executive orders, to sit there and say what President Trump is doing, which in some ways is much more detrimental to the power of the Congress. There's just a huge disconnect there. You should be consistent. And people just aren't. Obviously, their side can do no wrong. And I do think that's a big underlying fundamental problem in American politics.
And one person who seemed very consistent, for example, was Ben Sasse of Nebraska. He pulled a Jeff Flake.
Yeah, that was a terrible vote for him and his image in Washington. I think that that hurt him badly, that he is somebody that people thought had the potential to not only talk the talk, but to walk the walk, and he just did not do it. And then you have Senator Tillis, one of the all-time classics there, to write an op-ed saying you were taking one position and then at the last minute take the other position. If nothing else, that's bad staff advice there, too. I don't know how he came to think that was a good idea. Somebody asked me, what's the impact for Senator Tillis, I said, well, one impact could be that no one will ever run an op-ed by him again. I just think from my experience, politicians are just better off, you know, if you take a position on something like this, you just really need to stick with it. I just think it hurts you more. The waffling hurts you more. The looking weak or intimidated hurts you more. And, Senator Tillis hasn't been a very prominent figure here in Washington, hasn't gotten a lot of attention. And here he got some attention. It was really bad. And that's the kind that people will remember. So when you have those high profile moments, sometimes you want to make sure that you're doing what you think is going to be the right thing.
Still, when it comes down to it, I still think, and this could be a very isolated incident, but I still think that the thought that 12 Republicans having voted against Trump on a key Senate issue, I still think that was a big deal.
Yeah, I do. That vote should have been 90-10. There's always going to be a hardcore element that's going to stick with a president, but this was an assault on the fundamental power of the Congress. And if you're in the Senate, the presidents don't last forever. Your term is probably longer than a presidential term. You know, hopefully for most of those senators, they'll get a couple of terms. And it's hard to imagine voting with the president to gut my own power. And that's what many of them did. And I think that, it's going to haunt them a bit. And for the people, the 12 who might be getting some grief now from voters, I think over the long run, they're going to look at this and say, I'm glad I did the right thing.
Profiles and courage, right?
Right. I mean, it's hard to oppose this president if you're in his party because he has a really big bully pulpit and he's a bully. So he really uses the bully pulpit and it can be tough. It can be tough. And I think you mentioned Cory Gardner. Everyone in Washington is scratching their head at Cory Gardner. He's got a really difficult reelection scenario out there in Colorado. And for him to vote that way, I think people were just dumbfounded by it. I think that is a vote that some of these Republicans are going to regret.
Carl Hulse is the chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. Carl, thanks so much for being on the show.
Ken, happy to do it. I love this issue. You know that.
He'd say you've got to stand for something or you'll fall for anything. You've got to be your own man, not a puppet on a string. Never compromise what's right and uphold your family name. You've got to stand for something or you'll fall for anything.
Well, it happened. Beto O'Rourke, a former three-term congressman from El Paso who gave Texas Senator Ted Cruz a run for his money last year, announced he'll seek the Democratic nomination for president. He made it official in a video in which his wife, Amy, sat by his side.
Amy and I are happy to share with you that I'm running to serve you as the next president of the United States of America. This is a defining moment of truth for this country and for every single one of us. The challenges that we face right now, the interconnected crises in our economy, our democracy, and our climate have never been greater, and they will either consume us or they will afford us the greatest opportunity to unleash the genius of the United States of America. In other words, this moment of peril produces perhaps the greatest moment of promise for this country and for everyone inside of it.
He is the 15th Democrat in the race. Joe Biden, who many think will become the 16th, seemed to let the cat out of the bag Saturday night at a Democratic Party dinner in Delaware. He quickly caught himself.
I have the most progressive record of anybody running for the United States, if anybody who would run. With anybody who would run.
There are still so many questions about Biden and so many questions about Beto. And the good news is that Janet Hook is here to answer them. She's a politics reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Janet, welcome back to the Political Junkie.
Always good to talk to you, Ken.
Well, I love having you, Janet, as you know. And you know something, I'm glad you're here to talk about these two candidates because I have so many questions of the two of them, and they're so different. Starting with O'Rourke, it seemed a little odd in the lead up to his announcement. You know, he's the next Obama. He's the next Bobby Kennedy. He can save the party. He can save America. And then after he announces, well, he has a thin resume. He has no specifics. He thinks he's entitled. He's a white guy. Janet, did you know he's a white guy?
I did know that he was a white guy. And he's such a woke white guy, though. He has acknowledged that being a white guy might be a liability for him in this campaign. The thing about Beto is that he has this, you know, career in Congress. It wasn't long, and it was all when the Democrats were in the minority. So there was a sense of he kind of came out without great accomplishments. And his Senate campaign was not run based on issues so much as on inspiration and aspiration. And so that's why I think people feel like they don't really know where he stands on a lot of issues. He does have a voting record that we can scrutinize. But the fun thing is sort of watching his profile kind of take shape before our very eyes. He's been on this seven state, I forget how many state road trip since he started in Iowa. He's been driving and is dropping his rental car off in New Hampshire, and he's been making stops in Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, anyway. And people ask him about stuff, and he comes out with positions that, who knew that he might support the elimination of the Electoral College, but that came up.
But I think the question I have is, does it matter that he hasn't offered, the kind of specific position papers that, say like Elizabeth Warren has done, or even given specific answers to questions from Iowans? Maybe, as you say, maybe what voters are looking for is that inspiration and not the specifics, at least not right now.
Well, we'll see. I mean, that is kind of a central question. You and I have no earthly idea how this lineup of candidates is going to fall out a month from now, let alone a year from now. But for example, Elizabeth Warren is banking on the idea that voters really want to know where you stand, what you will do in detail. Like, the hallmark of her campaign is some really nuanced and detailed policy proposals on things from child care to government corruption measures. And it may be that voters don't care about that much detail. Maybe they do. And in Beto's case, maybe he'll come out with more specific proposals, but I think that's not going to be the essence of his appeal for people who support him. I mean, I think the bigger question is the ambiguity of, everybody hates labels, but people kind of want to know, is he a centrist? Is he a progressive? Is he a progressive centrist? And every time he takes a position on something, it kind of helps people get closer to pinning him down. He's definitely not the far left of the party. He's kind of, I'm actually not quite sure where he is on Medicare for All. I don't think it's a full embrace. That's the kind of thing that has kind of set off some progressives, that not only is he entitled white man, but he's not really very progressive.
Yeah, but I'm listening to you try to describe him, and maybe we shouldn't be describing people or putting labels on them or putting them in categories. We do know that he can raise a ton of money. He raised over $6 million in the first 24 hours. He drew gigantic crowds in Iowa. And so maybe it doesn't matter that he has a thin resume. But that leads to the other question. Why is he getting such widespread coverage?
Well, I do think that he's got kind of campaigning as performance art down. I mean, he really, and he's become such a sensation on social media that he's just created a sense of celebrity and curiosity for himself. Like, my sense is that those crowds that showed up for him in Iowa were not totally positive they wanted him to be president, but they sure as hell wanted to meet this guy if he's showing up in the middle of nowhere in Iowa, just because he's become a kind of social media star. And, on the fundraising, I mean, when he ran in Texas, his race against Ted Cruz in 2018, he was getting, online donations from people all over the country. So he kind of had this pre-existing fundraising base of people just ready to push the button as soon as he put up his website. For him and for all of the candidates who have kind of put up really flashy first-day fundraising numbers, we'll see how long that is sustained. And it's the same thing with media attention. I mean, at a certain point, maybe the networks will get tired of having a camera on Beto O'Rourke at every single event. It's a long campaign ahead of us.
Yeah, I was just thinking as you were saying that, there was an article in the Washington Post the other day by Dan Balls, who was talking. The whole column was about Stacey Abrams of Georgia and whether she may run. And it reminds me, look, we have all these candidates. We have 15 candidates running. There's so much to write about. And he spends the whole column saying, well, maybe Stacey Abrams should be running it. It reminds me of my son during Christmas. You know, if there were eight presents out there, he would open one immediately and then get tired of it because there was another present there and he liked the color of the wrapping. And then he opened that present and then went to the next present and the next present. It seems like we just were excited about the next president, the next candidate who may show up, who may announce, and you just wonder how long it lasts. But I will say, though, that with 15 candidates, having a lot of money, there's just a limited amount of money to go around. I think having a big fundraising base and the ability to get money is something that every candidate does not have.
True, but this thing about there not being much money to go around, I mean, the amazing thing is that everybody's hitting that $1 million mark really quickly. It's kind of like all of these people are waking up to the idea of giving for the first time. And I also think the fact that there are so many Democrats running is that you could still look at the field and say there might be room for one more, you know, a black woman as talented as Stacey Abrams. It's, first of all, a sign of how beatable Democrats think Trump is. And they say, you know, like, you don't get a glut of candidates if the incumbent seems really unbeatable. The other thing is, there's just all of these, this uncertainty about really what the Democratic Party is going to be about. You know, they're still in this, like, so the Clinton era is over, the Obama's era is over, what kind of a party are we?
I think one of the big questions, though, and I agree with you completely, but I think one of the big questions also is, the question is, what will the Democrats want? What do they want? Do they want somebody who's going to stir their hearts, or do they want somebody who can beat Trump? And maybe people like Beto O'Rourke can do both. I mean, who knows?
Right, right. And, you know, I have the same temptation to say, what do they, Democrats, want? And really, what we're talking about is there are a lot of Democrats that want a lot of different things. And the question is, where are there the most Democrats? Are there more Democrats who want a charismatic leader than there are Democrats who want somebody who's by the book progressive? You know, that's what primaries are for. They get to vote.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that leads me to the Joe Biden part of this conversation, because given the controversies over positions and statements he's made in the past about busing and crime measures and things like that, you don't know what the progressive wing of the party will see about Joe Biden. But if you look at polls, and I know I'm not allowed to mention the word polls in March of 2019, but if you're going to look at some polls, and maybe it's just name recognition, but Joe Biden seems to be leading the pack, and he has a bunch of committed supporters, or at least for now he does.
Yes, and so I would say two things about that. First of all, I don't think that the far left, the very progressive wing of the party, is going to start out behind Biden. He's just not their candidate, but that there are a lot of Democrats for whom he is appealing, not on an ideological basis, but because they think that he is the one who's best equipped to beat Trump. For the people who just think, we just have to beat Trump, I just don't want to take a risk on some unknown, untested person. Biden knows how to run government, and he know, you know, that there's this kind of comfort food quality to supporting Joe Biden if really you just want to be sure to beat Trump. So that for some people, there's a bigger question about whether he can win the nomination than whether he can beat Trump. And I actually just did a whole piece about the blessing and the burden of Biden having so much experience in politics. The blessing is he's very experienced and reassuring to voters in that respect. The burden is that a lot of his votes that he took in the 1980s, 1990s, early 2000s, while he was in the Senate, were kind of taking positions on things like crime and gay rights that are completely out of step with where the Democratic Party is today. And some of those votes he's reversed himself on or changed his mind, or he's kind of sort of apologized for how he handled the Anita Hill hearings. It'll be an issue for some people, probably more ammunition for people who don't want him for many reasons. I think a lot of people just say, look, like everybody else, Joe Biden has evolved over his 40 years in public life. Others will say, you know, really, that his instincts are just too centrist for a party as progressive as the Democrats are today. Others, you know, will just say, well, yeah, he's a centrist, but that's what we need to win in the general election.
Janet Hook is a political reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Janet, thanks so much for chatting with us.
Thanks for having me.
They will never forget you till somebody new comes along.
kid in town. Everybody loves him, don't they? And he's holding high, and you're still around. Oh, there's a new kid in town.
There are a record-breaking 6 Democratic women running for president this cycle. 4 of them are U.S. senators, 1 is a member of the House, and the other is Marianne Williamson. For years, Williamson was best known not as a politician or a political operative, but, for lack of a better term, as a spiritual guru. A best-selling author, for 35 years she's been writing and lecturing about awakenings and happenings and miracles on the journey to inner peace. She made her first and only foray into politics in 2014, running in an open congressional seat in California, the wealthy 33rd District, but she finished 4th. Still, she attracted a lot of attention, offered some out-of-the-box ideas, and had the support of people like Nicole Richie, Katy Perry, Eva Longoria, and Kim Kardashian. This is, after all, California. This year, she's aiming higher. She made her official announcement in January in Los Angeles, before thousands of people who came to hear her speak.
Let us not forget, we are not the first generation who has had to push back against assaults on our democratic values, push back against unfettered, unethical capitalism, and had to push back against deep human values. Let's just not be the first generation to wimp out and not do the job. And it goes without saying, that's why I'm running for president. The establishment isn't going to accept it. The establishment isn't going to want it. But you know what? The establishment are not supposed to be the gatekeepers. A political establishment is not supposed to be our political gatekeeper, and the media establishment is not supposed to be our gatekeeper. In a democracy, the people, we the people, are the ones that decide who's going to run, and we're going to decide who's going to win. Let us make history. Let us more than make history. Let us make this a more beautiful world. I'm ready for this, ladies and gentlemen. Please join with me. Let's lay this down. Thank you very, very, very much.
She has begun putting together a staff. She's spending a lot of time in Iowa, site of the First of the Nation caucuses next February. What may have initially put her on the map was an appearance years ago on Oprah Winfrey's TV program, where the host became a believer. What may really be significant to her career is today's appearance on The Political Junkie. Marianne Williamson, it's great having you on the program.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm fascinated by your candidacy, and not because of your positions on universal health care or free tuition or opposition to wars, but because of what seems like a simple philosophy that the nation's in a crisis and it or we need a moral and spiritual awakening. I mean, I don't know anyone who disagrees with that.
Well, I agree with that. I don't think anybody disagrees with that. I think it's kind of common sense.
But then the follow-up question is, and even if it is more necessary than ever, which I think it is, how does President Marianne Williamson make that happen?
Well, the issue is whether or not our domestic and international policies are aligned with the angels of our better nature. Are our domestic and international policies aligned with the same ethical, moral, and spiritual considerations that we consider important in our own private lives? I'm not talking about anything different than the things that all of us ask ourselves about whether or not we're doing the right thing, whether or not what I'm doing is ethical, whether or not I am who I say I am. The average person does deal with these questions. The issue is we have stopped recognizing that citizens must ask these things in terms of how our government functions. And if we don't ask those things, then there are other forces that gain dominance in our political system. And those forces are mainly economic systems. So right now, our government works more to aid and to advocate for short-term profit maximization for huge corporate conglomerates than it does to advocate for the people of the United States and the people of the world and the planet on which we live. So that's not like some mysterious concept. It's simply that too many times we thought we could farm out
our conscience and just hope that politicians were thinking about doing the right thing. And too often, politicians are not really thinking about doing right by people so much as they're thinking of doing right by their campaign donors, particularly now when corporate money can just flood our political system the way it does.
I was just going to say that this lack of moral leadership, these poor economic choices, this need for money, the hunger for money, is this because Donald Trump is in the White House, or is it much bigger than that?
No, it is absolutely not because Donald Trump is in the White House. Donald Trump is simply a symptom. I think Donald Trump is like an opportunistic infection that could not have taken hold the way it has were it not for the weakened immune system. And the each and every cell, each and every immune cell is every citizen. And we have stopped playing that part. And I think many people over the last 2 years have come to realize this, have come to understand that we have a responsibility as citizens in a democracy, not, but also responsibilities. If corporate lobbyists, highly paid corporate lobbyists who have authorization to spend millions of dollars in lobbying efforts are flooding Congress and flooding the White House every single day, it's not enough for us to just voice our opinion every 2 years or every 4 years at the voting booth. And I think that millions of people realize now that the situation has become urgent, that we absolutely must intervene. We must change this trajectory. And simply a better version of same old is not going to do that.
There's no question that you are not same old, but it's bigger than who's president of the United States. We're talking about Congress. We're talking about a lobbying system that is everywhere. Does the president of the United States make that big of a difference if everything else remains politics as usual?
Well, we have three co-equal branches of government. There's the president, then there's also the Congress and the two houses of Congress, and then there's also the judiciary. So we have 5-4 corporatist rule, what you might call corporatist rule, and some would say 6-3 right now on the Supreme Court. We have a fairly progressive Congress now in terms of the House of Representatives and the blue wave that we just had. But we have the Senate still in control, not just of Republicans, but of corporatist Republicans. So if I become president and you have a corporatist Senate, a corporatist House, then yeah, it's going to be pretty hard. But on the other hand, I think the awakening that's occurring is such that people are prepared not only to send a more enlightened voice into the White House, but also a more enlightened voices to keep sending more enlightened voices into the House and send more enlightened voices into the Senate.
Do you think, I guess you do, but I'm just trying to ask you, can any president restore moral values or at least help instill moral values in this country? I mean, certainly we've had people who've tried, Jimmy Carter, Barack Obama, we hear about their moral leadership and their moral, taking the moral temperature of the country, but nothing seemed to change. After Carter, we had Reagan. After Obama, we have Trump. Nothing seems to change in the long run.
Well, we can see with Trump, when the president is speaking in a chaotic, dysfunctional way, it has a negative effect on the country. And I think similarly, when the president is speaking in a healing, transformative, positive way, this will also have an effect on the country. The next president has to lead the healing process by which we recover from what will have been 4 years of a very unfortunate episode in American history. But at the same time, the president has to do more than just talk a better talk. The president that we need now needs to walk a better walk. So even when you have a president who talks all kinds of wonderful, more moral sentiments, but still morally equivocates when it comes to actually taking a stand for justice and actually challenging the corporate forces that dominate our politics. We haven't had that one in a while.
One thing I noticed in this campaign cycle is that a lot of voters seem very angry going into this election, and a lot of candidates seem quite angry. Marianne Williamson does not seem angry.
Well, I think that moral outrage is born of love. I don't think it's born of anger. But I also think that anyone who thinks that we will beat Donald Trump by being angry and tough enough is very naive. It's a very unsophisticated way of seeing the nature of the opponent here. There are millions of Americans for whom, for whatever reason, right-wing anger is less frightening than left-wing anger. And if those who oppose the reelection of the president lead with anger, we will not defeat the president. So I think that it's very important for us to seek to practice the dynamics of nonviolence. That has to begin with us. Gandhi said that the end is inherent in the means. So if all we do is get angry enough at Trump and get fierce enough and tough enough, he'll win. And even if we were angry enough and tough enough that we win in 2020, then they'll be back in 22 and they'll be back in 24. We need a deep change within ourselves. We need to politicize love the way he has politicized fear. You can't defeat dog whistles except by drowning them out with the voices of the angels of our better nature. We don't need to be displaying anger right now. We need to be displaying love, enlightenment, tolerance, non-judgment, and compassion. And that compassion has to also be extended to the people who don't agree with us. You know, nobody owes it to you to disagree with you. And today, you know, there's as much shutdown mentality on the left as there is on the right. You know, a smug, self-righteous, intolerant left-winger is no less dangerous to the emotional fabric of this country than is a smug, self-righteous, intolerant right-winger.
Let me get away from love and compassion for 1 second and talk more about the overtly political. What issues are you running on?
There are three issues that are the pillars of my campaign. First of all, there are millions of American children living in chronic trauma. Millions. And millions of children who go to school every day in schools where there aren't even the adequate school supplies to teach a child to read. And if a child cannot learn to read by the age of 8, the chances of their high school graduation is drastically diminished, and the chances of their incarceration someday is drastically increased. I see this as a national emergency, as a humanitarian crisis. And I think that we should save these children, rescue these children from their circumstances no differently than we would rescue them from a natural disaster. These children cannot work, therefore they have no financial leverage, therefore they have no way to compete with the clout of these corporate forces whose money flood our governmental system. This is just collective child neglect here. I would have a United States, cabinet-level United States Department of Children and Youth to address the extraordinary levels of stress and risk and trauma of so many of America's children. That's number one. Number two, I think we need to take the next step, next major step in racial reconciliation regarding the fact that this country had slavery for 2.5 centuries and then had another 100 years of institutionalized violence against black people in America. We need to take the next step in addressing that historical trauma. I believe there should be a plan of reparations for slavery for that reason. And the third one is a recognition that our national defense strategy is based solely, or certainly primarily, on preparing for war rather than on proactively waging peace. And we need to proactively wage peace. And you do that by expanding economic opportunities for women, expanding educational opportunities for children, ameliorating unnecessary human suffering wherever possible, and reducing violence against women.
I mentioned in my intro about your 2014 run for Congress. What did you learn from that campaign that might be of help to you now?
Well, I thought that it was legitimate for me to run because I understood the issues enough that I could hit the ground running. What I vastly underestimated was that I didn't know anything about political campaigns. It is a strange animal, a political campaign. I'm not saying I've learned everything I need to learn, but I sure as heck know a lot more than I did. You know, when Barack Obama ran his first congressional race, he lost to Bobby Rush by 30 points. So losing a congressional race is kind of like the political equivalent of the first marriage that didn't take.
You have an astounding 2.6 million followers on Twitter. How many of them do you think are politically active?
Well, unfortunately, I was told the other day that it's assumed that only 49% of the people who claim themselves as members of the health and wellness community didn't even vote in 2016. That's been a problem. I've seen this as a problem for a very long time. I've always felt that the people in the higher consciousness community should be the last people standing on the periphery. We should be the biggest grown-ups in the room. Because if you know what changes one life, you're the one who knows how to change the world. So I hope that this will change. You know, I need 65,000 unique contributors in order to make it onto the debate stage for the DNC debates in June. And it's, I have to say, it's disappointing to me.
that with all of the people who read my books and on my mailing list, et cetera, that I'm struggling to get those 65,000. And all that it would take is a $1 donation. Somebody goes to, goes to Marianne2020.com. If it even gives $1, then that's a way of voting for me to be on the debate stage in June. And I hope that will happen. But right now, it's still, I feel that people in the higher consciousness community are simply not in the cultural habit of contributing to political campaigns, and so are still vulnerable to this mainstream canard that only they, only their candidates, only that club should be considered the righteous purveyors of political power. It's ridiculous in my mind, because I don't think the same mindset that got us into this ditch is the mindset that's going to get us out of it. You know, I tweeted today that, you know, experienced politicians took us into Iraq. A bunch of philosophers didn't do that.
Right. You have said, I've heard you say that you believe that miracles do occur. Do you agree that it'll be a miracle if Marianne Williamson became the 46th president of the United States?
Well, the whole thing is just kind of silly, isn't it? I mean, Donald Trump is president. So well, what are we talking about? You know, it's kind of silly at this point.
Well, okay. Well, then the follow-up question would be, if you didn't become president, would that be okay? I mean, you would still be changing people's lives?
You know, for anybody to run for president, I would say is a low probability proposition. You know, who can say he's going to win? You know, especially we are 10 months out from the first vote of the Iowa caucus. At this point, somebody was telling me the other day that when Jimmy Carter ran for president in 1976, at this point in the process, he wasn't even mentioned as one of the top 50.
He was Jimmy who?
Yeah, really. So, you know, there's the dog and pony show, and then there's what's actually happening on the ground in Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina. And even though what's happening in the dog and pony show, where the media has assigned themselves the role of gatekeeper in a very un-American way, you know, when the media tells you who's running and doesn't mention somebody who actually is running, that really is fake news. And it's un-American. It's wrong. And within that conversation, I'm frustrated. But when I'm actually talking to people on the ground, rooms full of people in New Hampshire and Iowa, because you have to remember, people voting in the early primary states, they know they have the power. So they don't really care what the news media is saying. They know they have the power. And when I'm talking to them, things are just fine. And I feel that my words are landing. And my frustration at this point is that I fear that the media leaving me out of so much conversation is creating in people the idea, you know, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, and I'm afraid of that slowing down my fundraising. That would be difficult. That would be very hard.
Well, you have 3 months, basically, to make the debate stage in the late June.
Well, I have two. Yeah, no, but you need them by May 15th, so I have 2 months to get 30,000 more unique contributors. And I, you know, like I said, that's only $1 donation would do it. So I hope that enough people will say, yeah, she should be in the debate.
We'll see what happens. Marianne Williamson, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your having me.
Marianne Williamson is a best-selling author and spiritual leader who's seeking the Democratic Party's presidential nomination. Again, I wish you the best of luck, and hopefully we'll see you on the debate stage.
Thank you.
I'm going down, down. Going down, down, down. Unless we start a revolution, awaken from this frozen, start the mending of our union today. Unless we revive this constitution from shared disintegration, live out this revelation today. Smile upside down.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, since 1972, what presidential candidate announced a candidacy the latest and went on to win the Democratic nomination? The answer, Bill Clinton. He didn't announce his presidential candidacy until October 3rd, 1991. And the randomly selected winner is Chris Galdieri of Concord, New Hampshire. Chris wins the coveted political junkie button. And we have a scuttle button winner as well. That's that waste of time contest where you need to take a word or concept from each button I post and then come up with a familiar saying or slogan. Our last contest led off with a 2004 button that read, John Kerry, the real deal. Then came a Housewives for Howard button for former New Jersey Congressman Jim Howard, one that said, I love my SUV, one that said, Beverly Sills is a good high, and finally, two buttons side by side that said, Hill plus Tim, 2016, for Hillary Clinton and Tim Kaine. Now, going on the assumption that SUV spells SUV, I don't know, and remembering that two buttons side by side is designed to bring you a plural, so if you combine The Real and Housewives and SUV and Beverly and Hills, you kind of get The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, a show I don't get at all. Anyway, the winner is Ann Fisher of Columbus, Ohio. Yes, the host of All Signs with Ann Fisher on WOSU in Columbus. I swear this was legit. We'll have a new scuttle button puzzle up on our website this weekend. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com.
I've looked at clouds from both sides now, from up and down, and still somehow it's clouds' illusions I recall. I really don't know clouds at all.
He was never elected president. He left the Senate after three terms involuntarily more than 38 years ago. Mentioning his name today would probably elicit blank stares. But Birch Bayh, the Indiana Democrat who died last week at age 91, has perhaps done as much as anyone in modern American history to institute changes in the U.S. Constitution. He played a leading role in the writing of the 25th Amendment, which had to do with presidential succession and fitness for office. He was key in the passage of the 26th Amendment, which lowered the voting age to 18. And he was a co-author of Title IX, which prohibited discrimination against women in college admissions and sports. Bayh's son, Evan Bayh, was twice elected governor of Indiana in 1988 and 1992. He later served two terms in the Senate. 4 years ago, we had Evan Bayh on The Political Junkie, where I asked him about his dad. I used to see your dad on the metro every now and then, and he was always completely approachable. How's he doing? I can't believe he is 87 years old. I just can't believe that.
I know. My father was always the youngest this or that, and he is now 87. But if there is such a thing, he's a fairly youthful 87. He reads, he writes. Until recently, he taught a class at Washington College over near Easton, Maryland. And he still gets out and walks around a track near his house, three, four times a week. And thankfully, Ken is mentally very sharp. And so he's doing great and just very proud of him. And one of my sons, my wife and I have twin boys. And I guess the biggest honor I could pay my father is that one of my sons is named for him.
And actually, your first name is Birch, isn't it? Aren't you Birch Evans Bayh the Third or something like that?
Yes, we're not very inventive in our family. my father was named for his father. I'm named for my father, and one of my boys is named for all three of us. So I hope we can keep it a good name.
Well, I remember when he ran for president in 1976, the button said, I'm bipartisan. That was pretty inventive.
Yes, there were some mischievous takeoffs on that that were a little bit different connotation, but... Yes, it's an unusual name. It fits well on a bumper sticker. And, we had bipartisan, we had bi-American, we had, good things like that that the marketing folks in the campaign loved.
Senator Bayh, that was wonderful. Thank you so much.
Oh, Ken, I really enjoyed it. And thanks for asking about my dad. Yeah, his birthday was just 2.5 weeks ago, and we spoke, and he's doing great and a man I admire. And, who knows? Maybe one of my sons will go into the family business, too.
Understandably, it was not possible to get Evan Bayh for this week's program. But we do have Fred Nation, who served as Birch Bayh's press secretary during his final year in the Senate as well as Evan Bayh's press secretary during his two terms as governor. Fred, it's wonderful but bittersweet having you on The Political Junkie.
Well, thank you, Ken. I'm sure glad to be talking to you. In a sense, it's a sad time for us, but I look at it another way. Birch Bayh lived to be 91. He led a life of incredible accomplishment. He was in good health almost to the end. He died quietly at home with his family there. Not many of us could ask for a better end than what he had to, again, what was an incredible life and career.
You know, I was thinking the same thing. I was thinking that it's not as much as mourning his passing as it is celebrating his life.
Exactly.
Well, he had to be one of the most influential senators nobody's ever heard of.
I don't know that the memory of senators, generally speaking, has a good shelf life. They're known in their own state. I can tell you Birch Bayh is remembered in Indiana. Of course, a generation coming up today has to be educated. That's always hard, but I'm sure that's been true throughout our career. But he had just so many legislative accomplishments, and he was just loved by so many people. Even people who were against him, voted against him, didn't do it because they hated him or didn't like him. They may not have agreed with the votes he made. He took some pretty strong stands in a rather conservative Indiana at a time when our country was changing. But he was generally admired, always one of the best, most admired men in our state.
You know, I mentioned earlier his role in the writing and passage of two constitutional amendments. You have to go back to James Madison to see the last person who accomplished that much.
Well, that's correct. The two you mentioned are certainly landmark legislation, both talked about today in various ways. And two that he sponsored, wrote, and did not pass are also still very important to us. First, of course, is the Equal Rights Amendment, which was passed and ratified by 38 states. Indiana was the last state, the 38th state. It was three states short of ratification.
He also worked hard to abolish the Electoral College, and I know that didn't go anywhere, but I also noticed that many Democrats have been pushing that since the last two Republican presidents were elected, even though they lost the popular vote.
Correct, and that was the other amendment that he authored that did not pass. That's a tougher one, was then and probably is now.
You talk about the fact that Bayh was popular in conservative Indiana, even though he had liberal positions. I mean, he opposed the Vietnam War. He was talking about gun control when very few politicians were talking about gun control. And he also helped lead the opposition to Nixon's Supreme Court nominees, Clement Haynsworth and Harold Carswell.
And what a country we might have if Haynsworth and Carswell were on the Supreme Court.
Tell me about the man himself. What was he like to work for?
Gracious. You know, all his staff, and I say that with some degree of certainty. I can't say I know every staff member that worked for him over 18 years in the Senate, but I know a lot of them, and all of them loved him. He was considerate, helpful to staff. He wanted staff opinions. His staff members would do anything for Birch Bayh. They love him. They loved him then. They love him now. So I think his kindness and generosity, graciousness stand out to me as well. Of course, part of the reason he was so admired by his staff is because he was willing to take strong stands, which they knew and he knew were not always in concert with a majority of Hoosiers or close to a majority. And you have to remember, his largest victory was 51% for the United States Senate. His first election was 10,000 votes, which was one vote per precinct. So when you have a margin like that, most politicians would be pretty darn careful. And he listened to voters. Don't get me wrong. It wasn't that he was way out of step with Hoosiers, but Hoosiers didn't always realize what the implications were. And a representative that the people elect have a responsibility to listen to the voters, but also use their own knowledge and experience. I think Edmund Burke said something about that, which I no longer remember, but the principle holds.
One of the most dramatic moments of his life was when he and Ted Kennedy voted for the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and then they left for a flight to Massachusetts for the state Democratic convention, where Teddy was going to be nominated for a full term, and Bai was the keynote speaker, and Mrs. Bai was also on board. And the plane crashed, and two people were killed, and Ted Kennedy broke his back, and Birch Bai came back to the wreckage, pulled Ted Kennedy to safety. Did he ever talk about that?
Yeah, we talked a little bit about that, and he, the way he recalls it, of course, is as you described it. Marvella was hurt in the crash. The pilot was killed. Senator Kennedy's assistant aide was killed. Kennedy was unconscious. Birch was unconscious. He woke up to his wife screaming in pain. She had broken her tailbone and was, pinned in, not badly pinned in, but he extricated his wife, went back in, called for, is anybody else alive there? Had no response. So he took his wife and said, well, you know, we need to go get help. So they were in an apple orchard, and they started walking down the hill, presumably there was a road, and then he smelled gasoline. And he thought, oh, my God, I got to go back and check on Ted one more time because he's afraid of fire. So I went back and yelled at him again. And Ted had been thrown into the front of the plane by the part of the collision and was not, and he was, his back was broken. And this time he heard Ed moan, Ted Kennedy moan. And so he pulled him out. Now, Ted Kennedy's a pretty good-sized guy. And Birch Bai's a strong guy, but he said Birch has reflected that you see those incidents or hear those stories of adrenaline running and somebody lifting a car off of a pinned child. He said that's what it was like. He was able to take Ted Kennedy out of that plane like, as he said, a sack of a seed corn under his arm, and he pulled him out and saved his life.
You know, you talk about how history would have changed if you had Haynesworth and Carswell on the court, how history had changed had he not gone back and saved Ted Kennedy.
Absolutely. No question about that.
Bai also, speaking about Teddy Kennedy running for president in 1980, Bai also ran for president twice. He briefly ran in 72, but he ran more seriously in 1976. And of course, neither effort got him anywhere. Was that one of his great regrets?
We never talked very much about that, and Birch Bai was never one for regrets. Now, there were some, you know, certainly he looked back at what could have been or what he could have done differently. What was underestimated, especially in Iowa, was President, or then Governor Carter, and the hundreds, if not more, of volunteers that came into Iowa. And, you know, as we look back on there, that was not a smashing victory for Jimmy Carter in Iowa, but that's where he emerged on the national stage, and Birch finished, I think, second to him. There were several candidates in there, and my memory fails me on exactly where he was, but it took the momentum away from Birch going into New Hampshire, and where he needed to get to, he thought, was New York. But by the time I got to New York, they were out of money and out of momentum. So it did not work out. He was a good candidate. He had a good organization, but he had gotten in a little late, and, you know, those were different days. You know, we're talking about he launched his campaign, and I think you were there, October 26, 1975, at Shirkeyville at the farm. Just think about that. We have candidates every day now announcing a year before the first primary. This is late October, right before, 3 months before the first caucus.
Yeah, it was a different time. Allow me a quick story on the last time I saw Birch Bai. This is many years ago. I was getting on the metro in Washington after work, and I was making a beeline to an empty seat, which I immediately noticed was right next to Birch Bai. So I sat down, and we're both looking straight ahead. And without looking at him at all, I said, this is what I said, I looked straight ahead. I said, Homer Capehart, 1962, William Ruckelshaus, 1968, Dick Lugar, 1974. I mean, this was the list of the Republicans he had defeated in his successful Senate races. So Birch Bayh, who's also looking straight ahead, he's not looking at me, looking straight ahead, said, "Thank you for not saying Dan Quayle, 1980. And we had a wonderful chat.
What a great story. That's a great story.
You know, you witnessed...
And I could see him doing that.
Yeah.
You know, deadpan.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You witnessed his defeat in 1980 to Dan Quayle up close. What was that like?
Well, it was a close, hard-fought race all the time. And it was hard for any of us to assess the Reagan tide that was running. And that's what defeated Birch Bayh. Would he have won otherwise? You know, who knows, of course. But the fact that seven Democratic senators were swept out, I think, speaks for itself. It was very tough, and it was my unfortunate duty to let him know that he lost. That is, the race was called while he was on a plane coming back to Indianapolis. And, of course, I got him when they landed before he needed to meet the press, who were there at the airport, and the race had already been called because it turned out, you know, not to be close enough.
It was called early, and then I remember it was called very early in the evening.
Right at 6 o'clock, yeah, just and I'd had a heads up from one of the networks that this was a case as a courtesy, and it was a bad night. But, you know, he was so gracious, and what he has said, has always said about that is, He's not bitter, and gosh, he, for 18 years, the people of Indiana gave him the opportunity to represent him, what he'd always wanted to do, and he's eternally grateful for that, so he can't be too sad about that. On the other hand, or not exactly on the other hand, but one of my friends once asked him, "Do you miss the Senate?" And he said, "Every day." So he had unfinished business he would have liked to have done. But he moved on in his life. He worked on a lot of things post-election. He worked on mental health issues. He taught college classes. He worked on presidential succession issues. Those things, the Electoral College issue he worked on, he kept at it on that. And he had a great life.
Fred Nation is the Executive Vice President of Communications for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. In 1979 and 1980, he was the press secretary for Indiana Senator Birch Bayh, who died last week at age 91. Fred, thank you so much for sharing your memories.
Ken, thank you, and thank you for doing this, and I hope it helps alert some more people to the legacy of a truly great American, Birch Bayh.
Hey, look him over. My kind of guy. His first name is Birch, his last name is Bayh. Candidate for senator of our Hoosier state. For Indiana he will do more than anyone has done before. So hey, look him over, he's your kind of guy. Send him to Washington on Bayh, you can rely. In November remember him at the polls, his name you can't pass by. Indiana's own Birch Bayh.
I'd like to give a special thanks to Kate Cruikshank at the Indiana University Libraries for finding this wonderful Birch Bayh campaign jingle from 1962. And that's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Hey, look him over. He's your kind of guy. Send him to Washington on Bayh, you can rely. In November, remember him at the polls. His name you can't pass by. Indiana's own Birch Bayh.
Vote for the man who will do more for Indiana. Vote for Birch Bayh for United States Senator. Paid for by Birch Bayh for Senator Committee.